This week, we have the Parsha of Pinchas. And Pinchas, as we know, the episode is divided into two. The end of last week's Parsha, Parshas Balak, describes the act, Pinchas's act of on behalf of Hashem to stop the plague and put a stop to the wrongdoings. And the beginning of Pinchas is what's known as Schar Pinchas, the reward for that deed. And Rashi comments on the opening words of the Parsha, after Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Pinchas, son of Elazar, son of Aaron HaKohen, and the Pasuk doesn't even need to say any more in order to draw comment from Rashi. No sooner have you mentioned Pinchas' name, and there's already what to say. And Rashi comments, "Lefishayu ashvatim mevazim oso." For the other tribes or members of the tribes were denigrating Pinchas. Hareisem, they were saying, "Hareisem, have you seen Ben Putizeh? This person they called him Ben Puti, a pejorative term. Shepitem aviimo agolim lavodos kochavim." His maternal grandfather was fattening calves for avodah zarah. That is a reference to Yisro. On his mother's side, Pinchas descended from Yisro. So that's him. V'horag Nasi shevet mi Yisrael. And look, he just killed a Nasi, a prince of a tribe of Israel. Lefichach bo hakosuv v'yichaso achar Aharon. To that end, therefore, the Pasuk comes and ascribes and associates his lineage with Aaron. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Now, before we engage in Rashi's words themselves, what is happening, what are they saying, and what is the response, as we know, we always need to ask the pre-question on Rashi. Namely, why is Rashi commenting? A person is entitled to their name, and he is Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, so there doesn't seem to be much spur for comment. But as Mefarshim explain, in one of two ways. Firstly, it is quite normal for a person to be introduced by name. Generally, their name and their father's name will suffice, which means it would be sufficient to say, Pinchas ben Elazar HaKohen. The fact that the Pasuk is going the extra generation upwards, associating him not only, and presenting him not only in terms of his father, but also his grandfather, that is already cause for comment. There seems to be more here than just telling us who Pinchas is. There seems to be an emphasis on telling us where he came from. Alternatively, and this many Mefarshi Rashi also take this approach, even if it's acceptable to call him Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, that is exactly what he has been called not three psukim earlier. It's maftir for Parshas Balak. And as he's introduced, Pasuk says, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. So the full credentials and the full presentation has been given just three psukim earlier. The Parsha or the Chumash is not assuming that we will wait a week from hearing about him three psukim earlier to hearing about him again. And even with all the goings on of Maftir, nonetheless, he's been introduced. So to say it again, that already says Darshani. That's inviting comment from Rashi, and Rashi indeed is forthcoming. They were saying he's from his grandfather on his mother's side did like this, and Hashem says he's from Aaron. And that's why the Pasuk reiterates that he's ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. But the question, of course, is what type of a back and forth is this? What type of a comment and then rebuttal is this? It happens to be that it's the nature of people who have a mother and a father that they will be descended from some people on their mother's side and from other people on their father's side. So it's hardly a machlokas. In other words, if should you say he is from Yisro, the answer can't be, no, he isn't. He's from Aaron. Because in the end, he's from both. So what exactly are we doing by mentioning Aaron? That doesn't make Yisro go away. And that is why Mefarshim explain that here, the issue is not so much to say where Pinchas descends from whom Pinchas comes, but rather from whom Pinchas's act came. The act of Pinchas is a very, very sensitive and delicate thing. It was something where he decided to take action, although it was correct, but it is not within the standard purview of jurisprudence and judicial execution to do this. It's what's called halacha ve'ein morin kein. It really depends on the person if they are motivated to do this act, which in the end he put an end to the life of Zimri and Cosby in order to stop the plague. But it's a very, very sensitive act, as we said. Much depends on the purity of motivation. And now go find out where the motivation for this deed came from. That is why the Shevatim, when they are mentioning and emphasizing the lineage of Pinchas on his mother's side coming from Yisro, and Yisro's Avodah Zarah, and not only is Yisro is Avodah Zarah, interestingly, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe points out, Rashi doesn't say that they were saying his grandfather worshipped Avodah Zarah. His grandfather fattened calves for Avodah Zarah. Fattening calves demands a certain amount of cruelty. It's not for the well-being of the calf in mind. It's not pleasant for the calf. But there's a certain, therefore, unkindness that you have within the roots of Pinchas. And what they're saying is, and this act likewise derived from such tendencies and from such motivations. That's what they're saying. Which means when Hashem says that he is the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen, the point is not to remind us that he has a paternal grandfather, but rather to swing the center of gravity of where this deed came from. It didn't come from a place of cruelty. It came from a place which is Aaron's purview, which is Oev Shalom, Verodev Shalom. It's in the pursuit of Shalom. Sometimes in order to achieve peace, you may have to do something drastic if it's being violated in a drastic way. And this, therefore, is the back and forth as contained within Rashi. Where is Pinchas's deed coming from? And this remains, as we know, a very important and difficult topic. All matters of kanaos and zealousness and such acts, the level of purity of motivation that they need is something that always needs to be in place. And then go figure out whether it is in place, and it depends on who you ask and why they say what they say. In fact, what's also interesting is that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, again, while everyone is focusing on Pinchas, and this is often very interesting because sometimes all the focus is on one person, and yet someone else is focusing on someone else entirely. I mean, here is all eyes are on Pinchas. What did he do? Why did he do it? Where does it come from? And so on and so forth. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe is actually looking at the people that are looking at Pinchas. Where is that coming from, that discussion, this whole debate as to the purity of motivation of Pinchas? Sometimes, says the Rebbe, and if one may say, Ru'uyim hadvarim, Lemisha Amaram, sometimes when a person takes action, there is an impulse from other people to comment on it and to investigate it and possibly to try and impugn it and to catalog it. And the reason why is because when one person takes action, for everyone else, it's something of a question mark, as if to say, why is this person doing something? Why is no one else doing anything? It's not an easy situation to be in where there's a situation where you should be acting and you're not. And how do you know that you should be acting? Because someone else is. And that breeds this tendency towards, in order perhaps to assuage one's conscience, to start to debate and to comment on the act. Because if it's left in its full glory, that's then a glaring question mark on the other people. Why did no one else do this? Why does no one support them? Why does no one join them? Etc. Or to put it slightly differently, when one is in the presence of a communalist, it's very easy to become a columnist. One takes on the discussion aspect, and that way one's able to say, oh, it's not all it's cracked up to be, and it's not as pure as it seems to be. And with that, but the goal is sometimes nothing more than just everyone else making themselves feel better. I'm mindful of a comment of Rav Kook Zatzal with regards to a halacha in Hilchos Tefillah. The halacha states, that's in the fifth parak of Maseches Brachos, that one shouldn't sit down within the radius of four amos of someone who's davening. Okay, davening, that is to say, Shemona Esrei, the quintessence of Tefillah. When someone is saying Shemona Esrei, one shouldn't be seated. If you're also davening, that's something else, and perhaps if you're learning also, but just to be sitting there and doing nothing, one shouldn't do that. I mean, one shouldn't be sitting and doing nothing anyway, but if you're not doing much, at least you should be standing. That's the halacha, and of course, there's many, many details and many sub-questions. Kedarkam shel dvarim. But Rav Kook says, what does it mean? What's the underlying message? Anytime you have a halacha in Shmona Esrei, as far as Rav Kook is concerned, if Shmona Esrei is the essence of tefillah, and tefillah is the distillation of avoda, what we call, of divine service, so what is expressed as a halacha in tefillah is ultimately a lesson with regards to Torah living, generally. And that's true for so many things. And here too, someone's davening. The someone, and you're within their four amas. We know a person's four amas represents their makom. It's their place. You're in their vicinity, and they're acting. They're involved in avoda. That demands something of all those who are within that space. If you remain seated, you remain unmoved. And you can never remain unmoved by someone who is doing a positive thing and you are right there. Because if you remain unmoved, you will be moving in the opposite direction. Because to be callous in that way, or to be non-responsive, already is its own type of response. And therefore, someone's davening, recognize it. How so? If you're sitting, stand up. You can also daven, but even if you aren't, at least to be reflecting the fact and acknowledging the fact that there is a voda going on and you're in the vicinity of something important that's happening, that needs to be represented also by the onlooker, by the one in that location as well. So very, very interesting comment of Rav Kook. Much, much to think about. And again, not only in terms of discussing Pinchas, but also in terms of discussing all the people who are discussing Pinchas. That's its own topic of discussion. Well, Pinchas gets his reward or his rewards, Bris Kehunas Olam and Bris Shalom, and very shortly after that, we move towards a counting of the people. This is the final counting of Chumash Bamidbar. It's the final counting in the Chumash. Bamidbar begins with countings in Parshas Bamidbar. It ends with countings here. Hence, the name Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of the countings. And that is in Perek, the beginning of Perek Kaf Vav, and it will take us all the way another 50 or so psukim as it goes through all of the tribes and the families and so on. And Pasuk Kaf Vav, Se'u, Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Beis, Se'u es Rosh Kol Hadas B'nei Yisrael, to count all of the congregation of Israel, and that's the final counting. If we have a look at Pasuk Dalet, let's try and read carefully and see. Mi ben esrim shana v'mala. The counting is for those who are 20 years and upwards. Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe uvenei Yisrael, as Hashem commanded Moshe and Bnei Yisrael, hayotziim me'eretz Mitzrayim. As if to say, just as he commanded them to be counted when they left Mitzrayim, so too here. That's the pasuk. 20 years upwards, it's as Hashem commanded Bnei Yisrael when they left Mitzrayim. Rashi comments on the words Ka'asher tziva, as Hashem commanded. What is as Hashem commanded? And Rashi says, Sheyehe minyanam miben esrim shana v'mala. That the counting should be for those who are 20 years and upwards. Shine'emar, as it says, Kol ha'over ala pekudim, all of those who go through the counting, as the pasuk concludes, miben esrim shana v'mala, from 20 years and upwards. So, to be clear, firstly, on what Rashi has said before we try and take a deeper look. When the pasuk says that they are to be counted as they were counted when they left Mitzrayim, in what way? Meaning, from 20 years and upwards. And Rashi quotes the pasuk to support that idea that the count is only from those who are from the age of 20. We may ask, why does Rashi quote the pasuk in Parshas Kisisa that stipulates that the count is from the age of 20? We have a count which is much closer to us, which we referred to before, the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, which is also from the age of 20. So why does Rashi reach back to Parshas Kisisa and not closer to home, to the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar? Well, the answer seems to be in the pasuk itself. The pasuk says, as Hashem commanded Moshe and Bnei Yisrael, hayotzi'im me'eretz Mitzrayim, who left Mitzrayim, which means, presumably, we're talking about the count that took place when they left Mitzrayim, or shortly after they left Mitzrayim, which is the Parshas Kisisa. That's the first time they're counted. And that's why Rashi refers us to there. But the truth is, the entire comment of Rashi here is very difficult, for a simple reason. Again, if we summarize or paraphrase more correctly what Rashi is saying, the pasuk says this count is like the earlier count. And Rashi says, in what way? Just like the earlier count is from 20, so too this is from 20. That's what we're being told in this pasuk. The problem is, we're being told that in this pasuk anyway. Explicitly. The pasuk begins, Miben esrim shana v'mala, from the age of 20 and upwards. So as soon as I see those words, I know the minimum age. The pasuk then goes on to say, it's like the earlier count. And Rashi says, well, what is that telling me? And the answer, says Rashi, is the minimum age. But I've been told that by the pasuk itself. I don't need to outsource. I don't need to refer back and derive it from somewhere else. I've been told it right here. It's very difficult. What are these words adding? And the truth is that the beginning of Pasuk Dalet, not only have we been told in the beginning of the Pasuk that it's from the age 20, we've been told twice in these Pasukim. Because if we go back to the Pasuk of the Count, which is Pasuk Beis, again all here in Perek Kaf Vav, Su'u Esrael Rosh Kol Adas B'nei Yisrael, take a reckoning of all of those of the congregation of Israel. Mi ben esrim shana v'mala, from 20 years and upwards. How many times do I need to be told the same thing? In Pasuk Beis it says 20 years and upwards. In Pasuk Dalet it says again 20 years and upwards. It then says, and it's like the earlier count. In what way? Says Rashi. Well, in the sense that it's from 20 and upwards. I mean that it just keeps on coming back. So how are we to understand what Rashi means to say? So the one who will guide us here in our Rashi work for the next few moments is the Maskil David, Rabbi David Pardo, in his Perush on Rashi. And the Maskil David says, if you want to know what Rashi means here, the key to understanding Rashi's words in Pasuk Dalet, apropos of the words in Pasuk Beis, the key is to take a look at Pasuk Gimel, the Pasuk in between. So let's see that. Vayidaber Moshe ve'Elazar ha'kohen osam ba'avos Moav. Moshe and Elazar spoke to them, to the people, in the plains of Moab, Ayurden Yerecho, by the Yarden, Lemor, saying. That word Lemor is a long way from all the other speaking words. And that is why Rashi comments on the word Lemor, Amar Lahem. Lemor is that this is what Moshe said to Bnei Yisrael, Tzuchim Atem Lehimanos. He told them, you need to be counted. What that means is, the word Lemor, at the end of Pasuk Gimel, denoting Moshe's words to the people, they caption now the contents of Pasuk Dalet. Because this is what Moshe is to say to them. In other words, the Torah tells us twice that the minimum age is 20. But the reason why it tells us twice is because the first time in Pasuk Beis, it's Hashem's words to Moshe. The second time in Pasuk Dalet, it's after the word Lemor. I mean, Lemor is basically followed by a colon and speech marks. Because this is now Moshe's words to the people. Moshe is telling them that they are to be counted from the age of 20 and upwards. But why does Moshe say that? And why then does Moshe add, it's like when they left Mitzrayim? It's not to teach me additional information. The minimum age has been mentioned twice already. If you haven't gotten it by now, Rashi's not going to help you. The point of saying it's like when we left Mitzrayim is not to set the minimum age, but it's to establish the nature of the count. So as a Maskele David, you have to realize that when the Jewish people hear that they're about to be counted and they hear those all important words from the age of 20 and upwards, those words have a very traumatic association with Bnei Yisrael. Why? Because the last time they were counted from the age of 20 and upwards, everyone who was in that count died. That's what happened in Chumash Bamidbar. In the beginning of the Chumash, they counted from 20 and upwards. Whoever was in that count, post Parsha Shalach, in the ensuing 40 years, dies out in the Midbar. So it means the Jewish people don't really have very warm feelings towards being counted, and certainly not in the same way. It's a very interesting sentiment to relate to be aware of. And that is why Moshe, when he tells them this, he also explains to them why there is no cause for concern. And on the contrary, the issue here is not the numbers. The count is not the problem. It is true. The last time you were counted, everyone in that count died. But not because they were counted. Because they sent Meraglim. And because they believed the Meraglim. And because they started complaining. And because they rejected the land of Israel. And because they denied Hashem's, or refused to believe Hashem's promise that they'd be given the land. That's the problem. Once that problem is there, it will apply to those who were counted. But the count is not the problem. And how do we know that the count is not the problem? Says Moshe, because you were counted before from the age of 20. And it was amazing. Look what came out. The Mishkan. When we first left Mitzrayim, we were counted, we ben esrim shana, through the Machzis HaShekel. The whole project of the Mishkan came out of that. Lilamedcha, to teach you that if everything else is in order, the counting is just fine. And on a really on a deeper level, or more correctly, just a deeper way of expressing this idea, what Moshe is saying is you can never be in a situation where there is no notion of accountability. Because if misfortune befalls you, it's because, you know, when the Jewish people are counted, trouble happens, which can happen, but it has to be done in the right way. But it really is an avoidance of responsibility, as if to say, if only we hadn't been counted, everything would be fine. That's not true. If only you hadn't sent the Meraglim and believed their negative reports and everything that came out from that, everything would have been fine. So to sway the entire critical emphasis onto the count is a crucial error. And that is why Moshe says you've got to be counted again, to realize you've had a positive experience being counted and a negative experience, which means it's not about the counting. It's about what you do. And that is the message. Therefore, as Moshe says, I'm telling you, Lemor, as Pasuk Gimel tells us, Lemor, that it's going to be from 20 years onwards, don't worry. It's like we were counted when we left Mitzrayim, or it can be. That's up to you. Very positive things can come from it, as they did indeed there. It's important to learn from history, sometimes from all of history, not just the part of history that went wrong, and forget the part of history that went right, which means you completely misconstrue what went wrong, even when it did. So this is a very fascinating comment of the Maskil HaTovet, explanation, the psukim to confront them. They seem to be saying the same thing twice over, and then Rashi says a third time, to open up this whole dimension within the atmosphere of the Jewish people as they're being counted this third and final time. Well, as we move onwards, within the count, so one of the tribes, of course, all the tribes are counted, and among them is the tribe of Yisachar. And that's in Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. B'nei Yisachar, Lemishbechosa. This is not the first time that Yisachar has been mentioned. Of course, he's mentioned from the time that he's born in Parshas Vayetze. But interestingly, there is a discussion about Yisachar that relates specifically to Parshas Pinchas. And the background to this is as follows. There's something that we take for granted, and that is that the name Yisachar is not pronounced the way we would expect it to, given how it's spelt. It's spelt with two sins, Yud Sin Sin, Kaf Resh or Chaf Resh, and yet we only seem to pronounce one of those sins, Yisachar. The other one seems to be silent. That's very interesting. We should know, just for broader disclosure, that this is actually the matter of a very old machlokas. It goes back all the way to the times of the Gaonim, to the two masters of Masorah, those two who lived in Eretz Yisrael in the 900s, known as Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali. Ben Asher and Ben Naphtali are the ones from whom we have most of our Masorah in terms of questions, how to pronounce things, how to emphasize things, and so on and so forth. They were contemporaries. There are differences between them, numerous differences, and this is one of them. According to Ben Asher, they both lived in Eretz Yisrael, I think both in Tveria, in fact. According to Ben Asher, it is to be pronounced just with the one sin, Yisachar. Whereas according to Ben Naphtali, it's pronounced with two sins, Yisoschar. So there we have it, a machlokas, as old as it gets. And that means that we paskin, so to speak, like Ben Asher, that as we do with regards to many things, that it's Yisachar. The question is, why? I mean to say, there are two letter sins there. Why do we only pronounce one of them? So among the Rishonim, we find two very interesting answers, and they're so different from each other. Again, Ru'uyim ha'devarim l'misha amaron, if one may say. The first is from the Ibn Ezra. And the Ibn Ezra says that the reason why, this is the Ibn Ezra in the beginning of Chumash Shemos. The Ibn Ezra says, the reason why we say Yisachar and not Yisachar is because it's easier to pronounce. It's not the end of the world to say Yisachar, but it's easier to say Yisachar. For felicity of pronunciation, is to say Yisachar. And he quotes an example of this idea where one would expect a double consonant, but really there's only one. He quotes from the Sefer Divrei HaYomim. And there it talks about the trumpeters. And the trumpeters are called Hamechatzrim. Now the word Mechatzrim comes from the word Chatzotzros. Trumpeters, play the trumpet. Now if a trumpet is a Chatzotzeres, then presumably the trumpeter should not be Mechatzrim, but Mechatzitzrim. And yet, the Pasuk calls them Mechatzrim. One of those tzaddiks has gone missing. And here too, says the Ibn Ezra, or there too, it's because for ease of pronunciation, it's easier on the teeth, Mechatzrim as opposed to Mechatzitzrim. It's not a terrible imposition, but nonetheless, it makes it easier. And so too, the same here with regards to Yisachar. It is worthwhile pointing out that as much as the Ibn Ezra cites a proof from there, the two cases are not exactly the same. In that case, the word Mechatzrim, there is only one tzaddik there. The second tzaddik has been dropped. Here in Yisachar, it's never dropped. It's always sin. So it's there, but it's not mentioned. And that's, in a sense, then a little different than the case of Mechatzrim. But in any case, this is the very, if one may say, direct and straightforward and practical explanation of the Ibn Ezra. The Balei HaTosfos, and as we know, we have many, many comments of the Balei HaTosfos on the Chumash, they explain as follows. The word Yisachar derives from the concept of Sachar. And that's explicit in the Pasuk. Natan Elokim Sechari. So Yisachar means that he was given, Leah, his mother, feels that he was given to her as Sachar, as reward for something. The question is, as reward for what? Actually, there were two things that contributed in the schar of which Yisachar was born. And they're both spoken about in the Pasuk. Firstly, Leah has had four sons already, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda, and then Vata'amod Miledes, she's not having children anymore. Rachel didn't have any children yet anyway, but Rachel gives Bilhah, her handmaiden, to Yaakov, who has then Dan and Naphtali, and then Leah feels that she should do the same thing. So she gives Zilpah to Yaakov, and Gad and Asher are born, and then she has Yisachar. And she feels that that was Bisachar in reward for giving Zilpah to Yaakov, that there should be more children. That's the first thing. But there was also another contributing cause. It's the episode of the Dudaim. Those flowers, whatever flowers they are, it's a very enigmatic episode. Reuven finds them, he gives them to Leah, Rachel asks for them, and Leah says, in return for me giving you these Dudaim that Reuven found, so Yaakov will be with me this evening, and that, if from there, Yisachar was conceived. And the expression actually is Sachor Secharticha. It turns out, therefore, that the birth of Yisachar is rooted as Sachar in two things, giving Zilpah to Yaakov, and giving those Dudaim to Rachel. Having said that, Leah only vocalizes one of them. She only enunciates one of them. When Yisachar is born, she says, Natan Elokim Sechari, Hashem has given me my reward, Kinosati Shivchasi Li'ishi, that I gave my Shivcha, my handmaiden, to Yaakov. She doesn't mention anything about the Dudaim. The question is, why not? Why does she only mention one of the two? However, says the Balei HaTosfos, this is now expressed and embedded in Yisachar's name. Why? Yisachar, there's two sins there because there's two Sachars. But in the same way that Leah only enunciated one of the Sachars, we also only enunciate one of those letter sins, and hence it's written with two, but we pronounce it just Yisachar. So this is the very different explanation of the Balei HaTosfos al derech hamedrash as to why we call Yisachar what we do. I say we. However, as we know, difficult to say we about the entire Jewish people because that means you're accounting for every other single minhag. And there are certain communities or congregations where they actually pronounce the word Yisachar with both sins. Like Ben Naphtali, I'm not sure if they do that because of him, but the other minhag, as we've said, that's the minhag in among certain Hasidim. Munkacher Hasidim read it as Yisoschar. Of course, Munkach hails from the Bnei Yisoschar himself, Tzvi Elimelech of Dinov. I'm not sure that's why either, but in any case, so the predominant minhag is to say Yisachar, but there are those who say Yisaschar, and those are the two minhagim, because those are the two possibilities. I mean, there are, how many other possibilities are there? Well, actually, the answer is quite a few, but I'll only mention just one more, and that will bring us to our parsha, because there is a minhag, and Rav Soloveitchik says that this was the minhag in Voloshin, that the name is pronounced Yisoschar until Parshas Pinchas. And from Parshas Pinchas and onwards, it's Yisachar. Now, Dostav and Kenan. I mean, that needs now to be explained. Why should it change? What happened? And the explanation that's given is as follows. It begins actually with a Rashi. Rashi in the Pasuk that we have just referred to, Perek Kaf Vav, Pasuk Kaf Gimel, B'nai, well, I don't really know what to say now. I'll just go with the minhag. B'nai Yisachar L'mishpacho Sam. Tola, so what are the families of Yisachar? Tola Mishpachas HaTolai. Lefuva Mishpachas HaPuni. Oh, and the next Pasuk. L'yashuv Mishpachas HaYashuvi. So one of the families of Yisachar is Yashuv. Now what's interesting is we've met the families, that is to say, we've met the sons of the Shvatim already in the Torah, much earlier on. In the end of Chumash Bereishis, as they're going down to Mitzrayim, in Parshas Vayigash, you find the names of the tribe. But that's the Shivim Nefesh. So you have the names of the tribes and also of their sons. And there is no Yashuv there as a son of Yisachar. Instead, there's someone called Yov. Says Rashi, on commenting on Pasuk Yudalet, Li Yashuv, who Yov? It's the same person. This is not a new family. Who Yov Ha'amor B'Yodei Mitzrayim? This is the one and the same person of those who went down to Mitzrayim. Ki kol ha'mishpachos nikru'u Hashem Yodei Mitzrayim. Every family here derives from a family, someone who came down from Mitzrayim. So if they're the same person, why are they called something different? But there is a Medrash. And the Medrash says that Yisachar originally called his son Yov. Why not? That is to say, he had no reason not to and every reason yes to. However, as they approached Eretz Yisrael, or as they became aware that there is an Avodah Zorah, which is called Yov. And now Yov did not feel very comfortable being called Yov anymore, because he has the name of an Avodah Zorah, which was not known originally, but it became known subsequently. And that is why his father changed his name from Yov to Yashuv. So he shouldn't be called after an Avodah Zorah, or shouldn't have the same name. But where does that shin come from? It was donated by Yisachar. He took one of the shins or sins, aligned the dot, and Yov became Yashuv. That's where it came from. Therefore, in order to reflect that idea, this minhag runs by saying that as long as his son is called Yov, so both sins within his name are pronounced, Yisachar. But as soon as we're introduced to his son as Yashuv, so that shin is now, the vocalization of that shin has gone to Yov to become Yashuv. Yisachar becomes Yisachar. So these are some of the very interesting discussions with regards to Minhagim. And of course, it's a very basic thing, how to pronounce the words. These are three of the Minhagim. Certainly what to ponder there. Very, very fascinating. Let us move further now into the Parsha. Of course, the second half of the Parsha is basically Korbanos. It's the Parshas of Musafim. It's the Maftir for Rosh Chodesh and for the Yomim Tovim is from Parshas Pinchas. And it actually begins with a daily Tomid, moving from there to Shabbos, the Musaf for Shabbos, and that itself is is a discussion which we've had in the past. Why is it that we do not read from the Torah the Musaf of Shabbos on a weekly basis, as surely as we read the Musaf of Rosh Chodesh on a monthly basis, and so on and so forth. But either way, that's Uviyom HaShabbos. And we know the Pasuk very well. We know it from Musaf, Uviyom HaShabbos, Shnei Chavosim. So there are two Chavosim, two lambs, two sheep, as the Musaf. Ushnei Esronim, Soles, and then two Esronim of Soles. What is the background to that? We know that many Korbanos, the animal is accompanied by a mincha, which is a meal offering from flour. And the amount, the standard amount for a keves, for a sheep, is isaron. Isaron meaning a tenth of an ephah. Well, if you have two sheep and each one is an isaron, the result is shnei esronim. And that's what we say in the pasuk. But there's a very interesting shaila here. Because the idea that a sheep will have an isaron, a tenth of an ephah for its mincha, we're going to find it again and again throughout Parshas Pinchas. On every Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh. And how does the Pasuk describe it there? Isaron lakeves. One isaron per sheep. Or isaron lakeves achad. One isaron per sheep. How many in total? Depends how many sheep in total. But the Pasuk doesn't tell you the total. The Pasuk says one per sheep. Work it out. If there's seven kvasim, so there'll be seven esronim. But the Pasuk doesn't say seven esronim. It says one isaron per kevis. And we're left to do the math. If that's the standard, and I hesitate to use the term with regards to a kevis, if that's par for the course, so then why is it that when it comes to Shabbos, it says there's two kvasim and there's two esronim? Why does the Torah do the math for me here? Telling me there's two esronim. It should say, visaron lekeves. And if there's two, so there's two. And were there to be more, there would be more. It's a very nuanced question, but such a valuable thing to stop and consider, specifically because we hear these psukim the whole time. We assume that they're all the same, but they're not. Not completely identical at all. But what is the difference? Why, in brief, why did the Torah here give us the total, and with all the others, it just gave us the increments, one per kevas? You'll not be surprised to hear that the one who raises this question is the Meshech Chochma. And moreover, he notes for us that there is one other time when the Torah does this. It's back in Parshas Metzorah. The Metzorah also brings korbanos when he becomes purified. He brings three lambs, each one, of course, accompanied by an isaron. And the Torah says, Ushlosha esronim, three esronim. Once again, it has not said isaron lekeves, one per lamb. It gives us the total. These are our two exceptional cases. What lies behind this exception? Well, Meshech Chochma raised the question. I think maybe only he could answer it. Because Meshech Chochma says, actually, the reason for these two exceptions is exactly the same. It's just the reason behind the reason is different for each of them. And if that sounds a little bit abstract, let us explain. The Rambam notes, and it's an interesting question. If we say that every korban is accompanied by a meal offering, isaron for each sheep, let's say the seven sheep, so the seven esronim. So each isaron is prepared separately. What if they were all prepared together? What if a person took all of the flour and all of the oil and put it into one utensil and then produced one mincha? Says Rambam, it's acceptable. It's b'diavad, it's okay. It's not lechatrila, each one should be by itself. But b'diavad, it's okay. Okay, now we know. Says Meshech Chochma, generally, it's b'diavad to prepare all the menachos together. But sometimes, it's lechatrila. Sometimes the Torah wants you to prepare them together. How many times? Twice. in Metzorah and Musaf of Shabbos. And how does the Torah denote that it wants them to be together? It gives you the total. It doesn't separate them. It doesn't say one per lamb. It gives you the total because this one entity should be three Esronim all together, prepared together as one. Why? Says Meshech Chochma, such a sensitivity to the situation, the factors in play. One of the korbanos that a Metzorah brings is a chatos. As a rule, chatos, sin offering, as a rule, a chatos is not accompanied by a mincha. Because a mincha is really an adornment. And a sin offering and adornments don't really go together. If you're trying to get out of sin, you don't do that with ribbons. It's business. And therefore, it's not appropriate to adorn a sin offering with a mincha. But the sin offering of a Metzorah does have a mincha. Why? Says the Gemara, because it doesn't come to atone for the sin of Tzaraas. That's happened already. It just comes to purify him to be able to eat from Korbanos. And therefore, because it's not an atoning chatos, but just a purifying chatos, it does have a mincha. Amazing, we have two tiers of chatos. And one gets a mincha if it's to purify. Says Meshech Chochma, yes, but still. It's still pasnished. It's still not entirely appropriate that it is a chatos and you're giving it a mincha. I know it's a different type of mincha, but it's not so correct that you should have a mincha which says this is the mincha that belongs to that sin offering. Is there any way to remedy the situation? Yeah. There's three korbanos. Prepare all the minchas as one. So let it be bottle barov. It's part of a general thing. There is no one mincha that you can point to and say, that's the mincha of a sin offering. It's such a delicate balance here. Yes, but no. It's a chatas. It needs a mincha, but put it all together. Shouldn't be so noticeable. This is a chatas of a mincha. A mincha of a chatas. That's quite a statement. How does the Torah indicate that it wants you to prepare them all together? It mentions them all together. Shlosha esronim. And achar advarim ha'ele, let us come to Musaf on Shabbos. And I venture to suggest Musaf of Shabbos will never look the same again. The korbanos of Shabbos are an interesting institution not to use that word in an irreverent way, but a very interesting concept because they involve melacha. I mean, how many melachas are involved in bringing a korban? A lot. But obviously, by definition, if the Torah says bring it on Shabbos, you bring it on Shabbos. There's the shechita, and there's the haktara, and everything. But that's what the Torah says. And if need be, lahavdul, like pikuach nefesh. If you need to do it, you need to do it. Obviously, there's no question about it. But here's one proviso. Wherever possible, even if you have to do malach on Shabbos, if you can minimize the amount of malach is done, you do so. Can you minimize the amount of acts of shechita that are done on the two sheep? Not really. I mean, each one needs its own act of shechita. And so on and so forth. And then there's a mincha. They're accompanied by a meal offering. Can you minimize the amount of malachas that are involved in preparing the meal offering? Yes, by preparing both esronim together. So when you put it on the fire, it's one act. And so on and so forth. And you need it all together, it's one act. And therefore, because it is still Shabbos, nothing will get lost. Nothing will remain undone. But if there's one aspect of the Musaf of Shabbos that can be done by minimizing melacha, and it will all get done, and that's the preparation of the mincha. If you prepare them separately, it's two acts of baking. If you prepare them together, it's one act. Says the Torah, do it together. And how does it denote that? Ushnei Esronim. It mentions both Esronim together as one, because they're meant to be prepared as one. That is a chiddush lahalacha. And the Meshech Chochma draws it out from attention to detail in psukim that we read again and again, noticing the differences between the Musaf of Shabbos, or more correctly, the Menachos of the Musaf of Shabbos, as compared to and contrasted with the Menachos of the Musaf of other Yomim Tovim. That's certainly something to think about. I'd like to spend the remaining moments discussing Rosh Chodesh. And the reason why I think it's important to discuss Rosh Chodesh is because it's very easy not to discuss it. We know that it's there, we know what we do, but what it is or what's happening, sometimes it can, and we have one every month. Well, what do we know about Rosh Chodesh? Well, in our parsha, the special korbanos, Musaf, right, there's Musafim for Rosh Chodesh, which yields for us then the tefillah of Musaf on Rosh Chodesh. We also say Halel on Rosh Chodesh, half Halel. We'll get back to that. In the Torah itself, Rosh Chodesh gets two mentions, or gets mentioned in two capacities. In our parsha, Rosh Chodeshem, the korbanos, the musaf of Rosh Chodesh. Where else is Rosh Chodesh mentioned? In Parshas Balosecha, in the section of the Chatzotzros, back to the Chatzotzros, because when are they to be sounded? Says the pasuk in the end of Perek Yud, Uv'yom Simchaschem, Uv'moadeichem, Uv'Rosh Chodeshem. There's a special mitzvah of blowing the trumpets then, Utekatem Bechatzotzros. What does all this tell us? And what is Rosh Chodesh other than, quote unquote, simply the first day of the month, the first and not the second? Says Reb Leib Mintzberg in the Sefer Ben Melech. He's the one that's cast light on this day called Rosh Chodesh. Assistance in this discussion will come from consulting the Nusach of the Musaf for Rosh Chodesh. It's very unique. That is to say, it's unique. It's not like the it doesn't have the introductions of the Shalosh Regalim and doesn't start Atav HaChatanu. It has its own complete Nusach. And what does it say? Rosh Chodeshim L'amcha Nasata. You gave Rosh Chodesh to your people. Zman Kapara L'chol Todosa. A time of Kapara. A time of atonement. That's very interesting. We've already discovered that Rosh Chodesh is a time of kapara. I don't know that it's normally emphasized. Then what do we say? Biyosa makriv lefanecha siriyachatos. They would bring these korbanos. Zikaron lechulam yihiyu. There is a remembrance for all of them. These two concepts are highlighted as of specific relevance to Rosh Chodesh. It's a time of kapara. It's a time of zikaron. Zikaron l'chulam yihiyu. We don't mention these things. Even in the musaf of Rosh Chodesh, we would say even on the musaf of Shalosh Regalim or of Yom Tov, we would assume that Rosh Chodesh is, so to speak, less than the Yom Tovim, but there's certain things that we say about it that we don't say in the Yom Tovim. We don't say Kapara, and we don't say Zikar, but we do on Rosh Chodesh. Says of Mintzberg, what do these two concepts of Kapara and Zikaron evoke? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is Yom HaKippurim, and Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaZikaron. So when we say that Rosh Chodesh is a time of Kapara, and it's a time of Zikaron, what we're saying is that it has aspects of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Aspects, it's not exactly the same, obviously, but me'ein, a trace of. And the reason is not hard to fathom. Because Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are at the beginning of the year, and Rosh Chodesh is the beginning of the month. A month is not as important as a year, but a year is made up of months. Which means that Rosh Chodesh, the first day, it's almost like the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur of that month in miniature, again. And therefore, it has aspects of Kapara and Zikaron for that month. And what's of further interest is that there's room to say that these two elements of Kapara and Zikaron for Rosh Chodesh, each one derives from one of the two places where the Torah talks about Rosh Chodesh. In our parsha, it talks about the korbanos, and the korbanos of Rosh Chodesh are lechaper, si'ir zim lechaper alechem. The other place that we refer to, the parsha of the chatzotzros, of the trumpets, there the pasuk says, the Uviyom Simchaschem Uvadechem Roshechachechem Utekatem Bechatzotzros Viniskartem Lifnei Hashem Elokechem, and you will be remembered. So the concept of Zikaron accrues to the Chatzotzros aspect. And interestingly, that is why we say, as the Abu Dharam points out, we say Zikaron L'chulam Yihyu Useshuas Nafsham, and save them miyad soneh, from their enemies. Where does that come from? What does that pasuk say in Balosecha? By the trumpets, uviyom simchaschem, uvumodechem, uvrashechachechem, utekatem bechatzotzros, sound the trumpets, v'nizkartem lefnei Hashem elokechem, v'noshatem mipnei aveichem, and you'll be saved from your enemies. Interestingly, there is a bit of a shift. In the pasuk it says, v'noshatem mipnei aveichem, we say in the tefillah, utshuas nafsham, miyad sone, oh, you became sone, and that's its own discussion. Furthermore, and what needs to be emphasized here is that this is also true of the Sholosh Regalim, but in this respect, it's much more emphasized on Rosh Chodesh, the idea of Nizkartem, of Kapara. Another thing that we emphasize more on Rosh Chodesh than we do on the Sholosh Regalim is the concept of Shira. Because we say, again, in the Nusach of the Musaf for Rosh Chodesh, Uvishiri David Avdecha, Hanishma'im Be'irecha, Ha'amurim Lefneim Mizbachecha, right? We address or nod towards the Shira of the Beis HaMikdash much more, or significantly more in Rosh Chodesh, even than we do in the Sholosh Regalim. Why? It's also interesting that according to the Gemara in Maseches Arachin, the source in the Torah for Shira, for singing by Korbanos, is actually derived from this pasuk of Chatzotzros through Medrash. The Torah, Medrash Halacha, that is to say, the Torah never openly talks about singing Korbanos. It's derived from the Chatzotzros. But what that means is that the singing has, again, a similar effect to the Chatzotzros. What is the effect of the Chatzotzros? V'nizkartem lefnei Hashem Elokechem, to be remembered. And what is the effect of the song of the Shira that accompanies the Korbanos? To be remembered. V'nizkartem. And how? Why is trumpet sounding, and why is singing, and why are all those things, do they belong in the domain of Zikaron? Zikaron, what does it mean to talk about a day that we're remembered? Remembering is not the opposite of forgotten when it comes to our relationship with Hashem. Remembering is a recognition, a reckoning of the essence of the person. Sometimes we ourselves do things that would, so to speak, lead Hashem to forget who we really are. But on a day of reckoning, you remember, yes, who you really are. And that's how you want to be remembered. Lahavdil, people talk that way. This is how they would want to be remembered. Not by every single thing that they've done, but by the things that really represent them. In order to understand what really, really represents the essence of the person, you need to hear from the essence of the person. And that more comes out through song than it does through anything else. Because that emotional and experiential aspect of music, which expresses a part of the person which is closer to the core, it's easy and possible to discuss ideas in an external and detached way. But music is much closer to the heart. And therefore, when you sing, it could be that the things that you're saying haven't changed, but the way that you're saying them have. And the element of you that's being expressed is much closer to your core. And that's how you want to be remembered. That's why Shira is so central to Rosh Chodesh. Because Rosh Chodesh is a day of Zikaron. Zikaron Nechulam Yihyu. And one could almost say, again, to see the tears of how this works, the ultimate Yom HaZikaron is Rosh Hashanah. And therefore the tool of Zichronos and Rosh Hashanah is the shofar, where there isn't even a sound that comes from the person. It's only the air that comes from within the person, that pure essence, which then expresses a sound. Rosh Chodesh is a lower level than that, because it is enunciated by the person, but in the form of song. So you have the annual Yom HaZikaron through the sound of the shofar, and then the monthly Zikaron through the Shira. And I think it casts the whole concept of the Rosh Chodesh, firstly, the Zikaron of Rosh Chodesh, and the Shira of Rosh Chodesh. And that's why we say Halal and Rosh Chodesh. Halal and Rosh Chodesh is not a Chiyuv. It's not a Chiyuv Midrabanan. It's a Minhag. It's a minhag from the time of the Gemara, so much so that Ashkenazim make a bracha on it, like all time venerated minhagim. But the Jewish, that means the Jewish people themselves instituted, so to speak, the saying of Halal. But why? To give voice to themselves, to give shira expression to themselves. In the interest of what? To aid what? To aid the zikaron of Rosh Chodesh. That's I believe, is where, or perhaps part of where, the Shira of Halal comes from on Rosh Chodesh. So I think that it's such a valuable discussion from the Ben Melech, because Rosh Chodesh can come and go, and we know the halachas, and there's the extra tefillah, and then we say Halal, but to understand what Rosh Chodesh is, where it comes from, how many aspects there are, and how they express themselves, and what they connect to, and what they're meant to do for us and say about us, this, I believe, is the contribution that the light that was shone on Rosh Chodesh by Reb Leib Mintzberg on this occasion. Either way, we hope, Mirtz Hashem, heading into not such easy times in terms of the time of the year for the Jewish people, but we hope that we should be remembered the good. The Yale V'Yovo is all about Yale Zichroneinu. Every time it's a time of Zikaron, Zichroneinu should be expressing our true selves. That should be recognized and should be merit Bekarov to hear and share Yeshua's Tovos, Besoros Tovos, Yeshua's Venachamos. All the best.